Hey, guys. Welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I am not doing a show right now. I'm taking care of other business. I am I'm sending Ian Freeman the new Liberty.me spot, which I should have did already, but I'm only just getting around to it. That's right. There's a new Liberty.me spot. And part of the spot, you know what it says? It says, me and Jeff Tucker are going to start doing a show on there. It'll be like a video type thing where he interviews me mostly, I think. And it'll be once a month, and it'll be called Eye on the Empire. And that's homage to our good old dear friend Alan W. Bach. That's from the name of his column for antiwar.com, Eye on the Empire. So it'll be a little bit of that for Liberty.me. And that starts, I think it's next Tuesday. Next Tuesday night will be the first one. So that's pretty cool. Ain't that cool? Hey, chat room guys. JDA is in there. He says hello. Hey, dude. Hey, everybody. I got my left eye on the chat room. It's scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need an XChat or a Mozilla or a Chatzilla, I meant to say, or a Pigeon or any of those things. You can just use a plain old browser window. Go to scotthorton.org/chat. You're in the chat room. But if you like those external type chat sort of applications, it's an IRC free node chat called hashtag Scott Horton Show, which is also how you find me on Twitter. But if you want to join up the chat room, it's an IRC free node chat room. Free node IRC chat room. I don't know how to say that right. I don't really know what either of those things mean. I mean, I've had it explained to me, but I didn't understand. Anyway. If you know what those things mean, then you know that all you need to know is hashtag Scott Horton Show, or just stop by scotthorton.org/chat and hang out with the boys in the chat room during the show. I like having the chat room during the show. It's a good part of the show to me. Important part of it. All right. Yeah, cool. So here's another thing about scotthorton.org. That's where I keep all my stuff. All my interview archives going back to 2003. You know, I don't know. Maybe I could have come up with a better idea of something to do by now. I don't know. But instead, I've got 3,600 interviews there for you. Almost all of them on foreign policy stuff, anti-war stuff. ScottHorton.org/interviews. And check out all the other stuff there, including my sponsors and my support page. Anybody who donates $100 or more, you get a QR code commodity disc. If you don't know what that is, tell me if you don't agree that this ain't the coolest thing in the whole wide world. Sorry for all the double and triple negatives there. You figure out what I mean. But here's what it is. It's an ounce of silver, guaranteed, you know, exactly a troy ounce of the .999 fine and all that, just like everybody else, right? But there's no face value carved on it. Instead, there's a QR code. You scan it with your phone, and it tells you the instant spot price. It tells you the market price of the coin in real time. And you don't have to go and spend 75 cents on the Wall Street Journal. I don't know how much it is nowadays. And open it up and figure out, well, what was it this morning or last night? No, you just scan the thing with your phone. So to me, this is the future of currency on Earth. I ain't knocking bitcoins or anything, but why would anyone have government dollars again when we can all have silver coins? And they can all have QR codes on them. You could have certificates that represent them, too, and whatever. You know, I don't know. But anyway, I just think they're the greatest thing in the world. It's CommodityDiscs.com. If you donate $100 to help support the show, then you get a QR code, QR disc, QR code commodity disc in the mail. CommodityDiscs.com, Facebook.com/CommodityDiscs. Go and check those out. I just think it's great. I can't figure out why there's any other currency in the world other than this right now. You talk about natural monopoly, this is it. Isn't that the greatest idea ever? It is. It's my buddy Arlo, man. He's a real smart guy. Funny guy, too. Pretty good skater. He's all right all around. about as libertarian as hell. And he's got Liberty stickers all over his car. All right. Yeah. So there you go. Those are some of the pages you can find at scotthorton.org. All right. One more thing where I talk about myself before I get on with the business, and that is that a veteran of the Iraq War wrote a thing. His name is Christopher Rumberg, and he sent me a tweet about it yesterday. And what he did was he wrote up a review of the show for English class in college. I guess he's using that GI Bill and going to college. And so he wrote up a thing, and it was real nice, and I got a link to it on the blog if you want to look at that. And he was just basically saying what I like to hear, which is that he trusts me. That, you know, at least I'm not deliberately lying to you, even if I screw up. That's what I have for sale here. I don't brag about any PhD I ain't never earned or any kind of thing like that. I'm just trying my best to get the best writers I can on the show to tell how it is, learn it the best I can so I can explain it to you guys so that we can all hate the government effectively together. That's basically the only thing. I seek to discredit the empire in every way. And I don't have to lie because everything they do is evil and dishonest. And so basically all I have to do is pay attention and keep showing up. And then I get to say things like, I told you in 2011 that this is what was going to happen. And then as long as I'm still showing up in 2015, of course, whatever I predict ends up playing out sooner or later. Oh, good. Got Jason Ditz on the show. Speaking of which, Jason Ditz is going to be on the show. This is one of the reasons I was right about everything in 2011. The Libya war, I'd interview Jason Ditz all the time about the Libya war. Boy, were we ever right. Jason Ditz, he'll be on at 1:30. Cool. Yeah, man, there's a big NSA thing. What needs explaining and talking about. So Jason's going to help us with that. And also Christian Stork, you might remember he writes for Who, What, Why, or Did, or something. I guess I need a more recent bio for him. Anyway, Stork, I interviewed him before about Bear Brown. And he had done, I think, a couple of good pieces for Who, What, Why about Barrett, who's now serving time in the pen. Well, has been all along, but has now been convicted and sentenced. Okay, but that's not what I'm going to interview him about. Because what I am going to interview him about is the Spotlight article today on antiwar.com. Because I put it there. And, let's see. I guess I'll need the title in front of me if I'm going to tell you what the title is. Meet the forces that are pushing Obama toward a Cold War. Toward a new Cold War. How did I leave the word new out of that? I don't know. The first time I just... Meet the forces that are pushing Obama toward a new Cold War. And no, that is not an acquittal of Dear Leader that... You know, poor he is just a figurehead or anything like that. That's far from the point, even though the title sounds a little bit like that. Or not really to me, but I saw someone respond immediately. Oh, yeah, like it's not Obama's fault. Oh, yeah, no, he's not Emperor Palpatine of Star Wars, where he's just a lickspittle bureaucrat. Isolated and manipulated by all his military chieftains. No, he's the Emperor Palpatine of the Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi with the magical evil powers. There's a difference there, you know. Barack Obama, bad guy. Christian Stork, he's got his number, and this is such a great write-up on the different politics at play in... creating America's Ukraine policy, if you can call it that. And so that's coming up here in just a few. And I guess with that, I'll go ahead and give you the headline on the Ukraine crisis for you to chew on for a minute while we wait for Christian Stork. Amid Ukraine ceasefire struggles, both sides refuse artillery pullout. So apparently you still have this Ukrainian military force surrounded by the so-called rebels. And no resolution so far. Combined with an easing of the fighting anyway. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I swear I'm coming down with early onset Alzheimer's disease here. Something. Here's the thing I forgot to say. I'm giving a speech in New Hampshire. I don't know where. I'm not certain what city. But somewhere in New Hampshire, I'm giving a speech, and it's going to be on the 6th? Okay, I'm not doing a very good job of announcing this. And maybe I should Google it up real quick. It's called the New Hampshire Liberty Forum. And then, okay, so there's that. Speakers. I'm clicking on speakers now. I think it'll have my time on there. I'm way down at the bottom. Here we go. Let me see here. I am March the 6th at 2 o'clock. March the 6th at 2 o'clock. And here is the venue. The venue is at the Radisson Hotel in Manchester, New Hampshire. The Radisson Hotel in Manchester, New Hampshire. I'm going to be giving a talk called Against the Terror War, which means that those of you who listen to the show on any kind of regular basis will have heard everything I have to say in my speech already before 100 times. But, you know, I'm going to try to talk it to some new people and see if I can teach them some things. Because, you know, we're at a real turning point right now. I guess it doesn't really matter what happens in the Congress, whether they authorize the AUMF or not. I'm just going to shrug. That's about as important as an announcement of imminent troop withdrawals back during the Bush years. You know, it's just, whatever. Either way, I'm not so sure that's all that important. The 2001 AUMF already apparently authorizes anything under the sun. And yet, so... Okay, well, let me put it like this. Does it ever freak you out that it's halfway through the 2010s already, and you go, wow, it's already the future? I mean, this is to the teens what 1985 was to the 80s and that kind of thing. Does that make your mind explode a little bit? How far in the future we are already? And how many years we've been at this long war? And how in Washington, D.C., it's still September 2001. They're ready to start all over again. They succeeded over the past, 14 years in turning the Al-Qaeda threat and defined broadly. The ISIS guys claim Osama too, so you know what I mean. The very broadly defined jihadist threat, they've turned it into what they used to pretend it was. It used to be a couple of hundred guys. Remember Robert Dreyfus wrote that great article for Rolling Stone called The Bogus War on Terror, where he said, look, Al-Qaeda got exploded to death already. There were only a couple of hundred of them, and the CIA pointed laser pointers at them, and the Air Force dropped daisy cutters on their heads, and they died of it. It was a couple of dozen guys. Maybe, you know, 3 or 4 dozen that escaped to Pakistan after Rumsfeld surrounded them on 3 sides. And let them escape. I agree with Ron Paul. Ron Paul said on the show the other day that he thinks they let them escape on purpose. I think so, too. I don't claim to know everything about that battle that I really should, but from what I've read of it, it sure seems like Rumsfeld and Franks decided to let him go. And maybe higher than that. He's just too good of an Emmanuel Goldstein enemy out there, you know? Anyway, Back then, there were only a few dozen guys. A few dozen guys. A couple of score, maybe, that were Al-Qaeda in the world. And now, they got the Islamo-fascist caliphate. They used to pretend they were fighting back when they were creating it. And now, according to Washington, D.C., and the entire media consensus, the only question is, when is Obama going to start doing more? That's all they have to say. That's all every article says. That's all every politician says. That's all the entire Republican Party says, including Rand Paul. Obama's not doing enough to fight the Islamic State. We had more debate about whether to start the war in 2003. I mean, as sad as it is to say that, and as harsh as the whole, consensus, it was threatening in a way, you know, everybody who is not on board is a traitor and all that kind of thing. But you know what? Still, the majority of the Democrats in the House voted against it. I mean, they were in the minority, so it wasn't that brave of a stance to take, really, but they did vote against it. It was possible to, you know, but with this ISIS thing, I don't know. It's already on. It's not like Congress is going to stop them from doing it, and Obama's been bombing them for half a year now. And, you know, I don't know, man. I don't know what to say, really. I don't know what my point is other than I got a real bad feeling about this. I think that the American people are just not plugged in enough. They don't have reason enough to think that, no, we got to stop this right now. Is, hey, everybody's saying we gotta do this, right? I don't know. That's how decisions are made, man. It seems like everybody else thinks so. And yet all they can do is exactly what these guys want, which is for the Americans to come and fight them. That's exactly what they want. That's why they had their guys do the attack on the Coptic Christians, the Egyptian Coptic Christians in Libya. That's why they burned the Jordanian pilot to death in a cage and put it on YouTube. That's why they cut American journalists' heads off while asking what color panties Barack Obama was wearing. They're trying to provoke a further war. That's who they are. They're fighters. They need wars to fight. Now, there's this new thing in The Atlantic, which is getting a lot of justified criticism, I think. But it's also useful, worth a read anyway, of the apocalyptic, I mean, read it very critically, but still, the apocalyptic view of these guys. They think they're headed for final Armageddon or this or that. And the Americans, and I guess some Americans would think, fine, go ahead and give it to them then. But that's not what's going to happen, of course. All that's going to happen is the Americans are going to eventually end up occupying Iraqi Sunnistan. And turning these guys back into an insurgency and just driving this whole thing on and on and on. And there is no grand design. I miss the days when I was a conspiracy kook and I thought the Skull and Bones decided all these policies or something, that there was even a policy. You know, the reason that the Secretary of Defense left is because there is not a Syria policy. Because they can't decide on one for political reasons. They can't do this, that, or the other thing, so they're doing all of them. And all in contradiction. And as long as the bureaucrats move up a step and the contractors make their money, the empire rolls on.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, you guys, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. More bad news and Jason Ditz coming up. But first, it's Christian Stork. He's at whowhatwhy.com, and here he is writing at medium.com/@Christian Stork. That's a weird way they do that. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Good to talk to you again. And a great piece of writing here. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. It's called Meet the Forces That Are Pushing Obama Toward a New Cold War. And, boy, it sure is, I don't know how wide, but a pretty deep array of forces aligned to, you know, work to keep America's Ukraine policy at least where it is, apparently. As mad as that sounds in terms of what the average American might imagine as the national interest, it's in somebody's interest. So break it down, man. What's behind all this?
Sure. So my article basically gives a background on the authors and the organizations behind the authors of the recent joint think tank report. It was put out by the Brookings Institute, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and the Atlantic Council. And I know you've had a few guests on recently. I think Scott McConnell was one of them, discussing that report. The report was infamous for the way it advocated sending $1 billion in $1 billion in military aid to the coup government in Kiev to help, in their words, deter Russian aggression. And I came across it because I saw the press conference that Obama had given with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And in that, he said that he was considering the idea of defensive weaponry, and all of the news articles about that conference linked to the think tank report. And I was curious about, you know, what would defensive weaponry mean? You know, defensive and offensive, they seem like labels that only pertain to the manner in which weaponry is employed, not in the sense of the way weaponry is designed. But then in a number of the articles, they specifically referenced the Javelin anti-tank missile. And so I read about the Javelin. I found out it's made by General Dynamics. And then I look at the first author of this report, and it's Ivo Dalder. He's a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and the president of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And I go to the Chicago Council's website, and then boom, right there, you see that the chairman of the board is Lester Crown, who owns $3.5 billion in General Dynamics shares. So it was really just, you know, there's no feat of journalism being done here. It just basically took me an afternoon and some digging. And what you find is this huge nexus of former government officials and defense contractors and think tank analysts. And it's, you know, it's just a giant pool of, I would consider it basically corruption, but in a sense, just these people are hawking wares that they're getting paid to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. You know, maybe it's, even though Ike said it, and Ike is the definition of, you know, normalcy and legitimacy in you know, modern America or whatever, pre-modern, he said it, but maybe it's the word complex that people go, oh, that sounds complex. Something, or just sounds like it's, you're the one connecting the dots. The dots aren't necessarily connected. For some reason, that phrase, rather than being, you know, so explanatory to people that everybody understands it and agrees that, you know, obviously that's some of what's at play. It's kind of, it marginalizes the person using it. It sounds like at least the tinge of a conspiracy theory or whatever, when instead, as you're writing here, this is just business and politics. That's all it is. You don't need any fancy terms for it at all. It's just, well, how does a Raytheon salesman get rid of weapons? Well, he lobbies. You know, he comes up with, he hires people to write reports about why they need his weapons. That's no surprise. There's nothing fancy or even, it's almost, in our imperial society now, it's not even considered a conflict of interest at all. It's just exactly how business works. It's like I interviewed this professor a couple weeks ago about the Iron Triangle and the economics of it, and how none of these people believe what they're doing is wrong at all. It's just, this is the system.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that they really shouldn't believe that they're doing anything wrong. They're just capitalizing on their knowledge that they've accrued throughout their entire life, particularly in government service. And when you're working for the military and then you take all of that knowledge and you put it to good use and make a buck off of it and take care of your family, what's wrong with that? But there is something wrong with that in the sense that it's bringing the U.S. in this particular case perilously close to a conflict with a nuclear-armed power like Russia. And luckily, there's been a lot of pushback from the more realist centers in the Washington think tank ecosystem. But nevertheless, the report itself, I think, is astonishing for the way that the organizations are so intimately connected with the firms that would benefit the most from this sort of military assistance to Ukraine. So, you know, in the report, the Brookings Institute is one of the primary authors of the Strobe Talbot is the author listed from the Brookings Institute in the report, and he was the president. He's been the president of Brookings since 2002. Now, Brookings has a pretty interesting history. It's founded in 1916. It's the oldest think tank in Washington. It was founded by Robert S. Brookings, who was a commissioner of finished products on the War Industries Board and the commissioner of price. He was the commissioner of the Price Fixing Committee. So you see, when you investigate the history behind a lot of these think tanks, particularly the Council on Foreign Relations, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which used to be the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, they all basically come up after World War I. Now, I haven't nailed this down pat, but I do know that following World War I, U.S. business was extremely keen on maintaining the level of industrial output that they had reached during the war mobilization. So essentially, you see these think tanks coming up with all sorts of nifty intellectual justifications for keeping American military industry going following the war and following the demobilization that came after it. So Brookings is basically the first one in the line of those think tanks. And Strobe Talbot became its president in 2002. Now, Brookings used to have a very large endowment, and it would get these huge grants from foundations. And a lot of the foundations themselves were funded by military industry and any sort of business that was interested in impacting U.S. government policy, particularly in the international arena. But from 2003 to 2013, under Strobe Talbot's reign, Brookings went from $32 million in annual revenues to $100 million. So he went on an aggressive corporate fundraising tact. And among those donors was Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, and really a whole host, like I said, any organization, any corporate organization that was interested in impacting government policy toward its financial interests. And one of the biggest donors to Brookings in that period has been Booz Allen Hamilton, donating between $1 and $2.5 million. If you look at Brookings disclosure forms, they only set out levels that corporate donors give in. So you'll have 50,000 to 100,000, then they'll list a bunch of corporations, and then 1 million to 2.5 million, they'll list a bunch. So Booz Allen Hamilton was one of the main donors during that time. And then when you look at the Brookings Institute board, you find that their co-chair of their board is David M. Rubenstein. Now, David M. Rubenstein is the co-founder and CEO of the Carlyle Group. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Carlyle Group. It's a private equity firm based in D.C. It's made most of its money off of defense investments and profiting off of extremely close connections between its personnel and the Pentagon and defense industry. It's actually divested from a number of its defense investments since it became pretty famous following 9/11. But Carlyle took Booz Allen in 2010, and by 2013, Carlyle, which owns Booz, a majority stake in Booz Allen, has made over $2 billion off of Booz.
All right, hold it right there. We'll talk about Brookings money a little bit more with Christian Stork right after this. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, guys, welcome back. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. talking with Christian Stork. He's at whowhatwhy.com. This one is at medium.com. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Calm. It's called Meet the Forces That Are Pushing Obama Toward a New Cold War. And we're right at the good part. So we're talking about the Brookings Institution, the oldest, as he says, and right there with the Council on Foreign Relations, most prestigious and perceived realist and responsible and center-left-ish realist. Did I say realist already? And yet, Brookings is completely for sale and by arms manufacturers, even more than bankers now, it looks like. And so we're talking about all that. Christian's explaining about Raytheon, and hadn't even really gotten into Lockheed yet, I don't think. But now we're at Booz Allen Hamilton, Carlyle Group, and Booz Allen Hamilton, and their role in bankrolling Brookings, which is calling for the arming of the Ukrainian coup government, as Christian explained. But you say here, too, Booz has been working with USAID in Ukraine. They helped bring us to this crisis in the first place.
That's exactly right. They've been involved with USAID since at least 2011. I haven't been able to find any contracts prior to that. But as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, USAID is essentially, it's taken over what used to be functions of the CIA that would be conducted in antagonistic countries, countries antagonistic toward the U.S. in terms of whipping up public support for quote-unquote democratic movements, propaganda against the ruling regime, all sorts of shady things. USAID was instrumental in creating that whole Cuban Twitter. I knew that was a story from last year. So USAID has a pretty shady history, and Booz has been involved in that. Now, Booz is majority owned by the Carlyle Group. So you have the co-chair of the board of trustees at Brookings is the co-founder and CEO of Carlyle, who's a major company of his is one of the premier donors to one of the premier donors to Brookings. And then Brookings, in turn, is advocating for more business for Booz. And, you know, Booz is literally the definition of the revolving door. They have 9 executives who used to work for the NSA, 20 executives who used to work for the Navy, 17 who used to work for the Army, 12 who used to work for the Air Force, 7 who used to work for the CIA, and 3 who used to work in upper-level management in the Pentagon. And Ronald Sanders, who also used to work at the Pentagon. He's now on the faculty at Brookings, as well. And Ken Duberstein is also a trustee, and he is a director at Boeing. So Brookings, I wouldn't necessarily say it's entirely bankrolled by the arms manufacturers. If you look at their trustees, they have a wide swath of corporate America represented. But if you look at the sorts of industries, they're all industries with really strong international market. Basically, they're industries that are heavily involved in exporting. So they,
well, of course, there's the Sabin Center there now from Haim Sabin from the Power Rangers, who gave millions and millions to create a whole special center at Brookings just for Middle Eastern studies. So it's just kind of a taste of where they're coming from. He's basically like a Sheldon Adelson type. I don't know if anybody's that bad, but pretty close.
Yeah, he's actually the mirror image of Sheldon Adelson. He was one of the top Democratic Party fundraisers, where Sheldon Adelson is one of the top Republican Party fundraisers. And, you know, it's not just pro-Israel hawks. It's also the government of Qatar was one of the premier donors to Brookings, and then they set up the Brookings Doha Center on their behalf. There was a great Washington Post investigation of Brookings. I think it was either last year or in 2013, and I linked to it in my article that goes into all of this. They focus mainly on the foreign funding because that was the most nefarious in the Washington Post's view. But if you look at this at Brookings in general, it's essentially a pay-to-play research hub for all of corporate America and indeed the entire corporate world.
Awesome. All right, now tell us all about the Atlantic Council.
Sure. So the Atlanta Council was formed in 1961. It was, according to its website, it was formed as a consolidation of U.S. citizen groups that were supporting NATO. Major donors to the Atlanta Council include SAIC, EADS, Lockheed, Raytheon, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, all the usual players. The Atlanta Council, I would say, is in a similar line, in a similar vein as Brookings, in a sense that it bills itself as very centrist, and it basically culls most of its intellectual prowess from the, you know, that whole trilateral commission area of expertise in terms of the major economic centers on both sides of the Atlantic. So if you look at the Atlantic Council, its chairman is James L. Jones, who is a former director of Boeing as well as a former director of General Dynamics. One of its directors is Stephen Hadley, and Stephen Hadley plays a very important part in this entire push against Russia, really beginning after the Cold War. He was a national security advisor to George W. Bush. He was also on the chair of the U.S. Committee to Expand NATO, which was a half lobby group, half think tank that was started in 1996 to aggressively push for including the former Warsaw Pact countries into NATO. And then that resulted in massive weapons sales on behalf of mostly Lockheed Martin, basically the entire U.S. defense industry. He was a former lawyer for Shea and Gardner, a D.C. Boutique law firm that used to represent Lockheed Martin. And he's currently a director at Raytheon. Also a director of the Atlantic Council is a longtime Republican operative named Julie Finley. She was also on the board of the U.S. Committee to Expand NATO. She was famous for hosting many congresspeople at her house where they would be wined and dined and convinced to fund NATO expansion. Also a director at the Atlantic Council is retired General James Cartwright. He is a director at Raytheon as well. He got $124,000 from them in 2012. He's also an advisor to TASC, Accenture, and Enlightenment Capital, which is an investment firm with heavy defense investments. Also a director, Atlantic Council, is Michelle Flournoy. She's also one of the report's authors. She's a former Undersecretary of Defense.
She's very important. She was part of the ringleader of the Center for a New American Security counterinsurgency crowd pushing for the surge in Afghanistan, and that whole little consensus with McChrystal, Petraeus, and all them, and rolling Obama, forcing Obama, sort of against his will in November of 2009 to do the surge, which then she was in charge of implementing in the policy shop at the Pentagon, where she failed completely. Sorry, but important.
No, it's completely right, and I don't focus on her in the piece because, as you said, she's more affiliated with the Center for New American Security. But you know, these conclusions basically extrapolate broadly. The Center for New American Security is just as corrupted as both the Atlanta Council, Brookings, and the Chicago Council. In fact, the Center for New American Security, one of its former directors, he recently stepped down, was Norm Augustine, who was the former CEO of Lockheed Martin. So back to the Atlantic Council, though. Mm-hmm. Another director is Michael Hayden, who everyone should know is the former director of NSA and CIA. He's also a principal at the Chertoff Group. He serves on the board of Allianz Science and Technology and on the advisory board of Next Century Corp. Those are both technology-related defense contractors. And an honorary director of the Atlantic Council is former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She is a chair of the National Democratic Institute. That's one of the organizations comprising the National Endowment for Democracy, which is involved heavily with USAID on all of these shady democracy promotion activities abroad, particularly in Eastern Europe. I'm sure your audience might be familiar. I know that Justin Raimondo has done a lot of great work on this. The color revolutions that have occurred in many of the post-Soviet states, all of those have very strong links to the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID. And she's also the chair of Albright Capital Management, which invests in emerging markets. Now, I haven't been able to find any investments in Ukraine just yet, but I know that in 2012, Albright Capital Management bid for a Kosovo telecom, which is pretty interesting because Madeleine Albright, in her capacity as Secretary of State, was instrumental in pushing a hard hard anti-Russian line in the entire Kosovo conflict. So she is very, I would consider, just as corrupt as any of the other players we're discussing.
Mm-hmm. All right, now in last very little time, no, we got none. Hell. Well, everybody got to go read it now because there's a whole section too on harvesting Ukraine and the role of giant agribusiness. Monsanto, that makes everybody alarmed. Monsanto, everyone. Go and finish and read this great article by Christian Stork. It's at medium.com. It's the spotlight on antiwar.com today. Meet the forces that are pushing Obama toward a new Cold War. Thank you very much, Christian. Great work.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America. Columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com. That's interesting. Interesting things are interesting to me. Some of them. All right, well, anyway. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. That was Christian Stork. Go find the article. It's at Medium something something. I don't know how that website works. There's no links to anything anywhere on the damn thing. I mean, I guess it's a good-looking page, whatever page it is, with the fancy pictures and the nice nicely illustrated text. But where are the links to the things? How can I find where the stuff is at? I don't know. But if you go to antiwar.com, then that's easy enough. Right there is the spotlight in the middle of the page under the big word spotlight. And there's the article. And it's about a whole bunch of interests involved and who's back in the think tanks, who are back in the war. And now, isn't it interesting how, and I guess I could have, would have, should have thought of it, start the interview this way. Isn't it funny how Strobe Talbot and all these supposed center-left realist establishment types that, the loonies who preceded the crazies, as Joe Stromberg might say, that these guys were calling for arming the Ukrainian military just last week, and now we have a peace deal. Boy, did they have egg all over their faces, am I right? Is anybody noticing how wrong they were when their answer was escalate last week? Well, escalate? Why, we got ourselves a peace deal. And okay, it's not perfect, and it may not last. But escalation was better than trying when at least we got this far. We got the president of Ukraine and the Russians, who do have great influence over the separatists or whatever you label them in the east they're fighting. And so, and with the Germans and the French on board too. Saying, yeah, no, we really mean it. Minsk 2, it's on. So Strobe Talbot has to go drown himself in the pool or something now, right? What in the hell is the matter with you, Strobe? Where the hell is Michelle Flournoy this week? Hey, Michelle, you're a worse person than Vladimir Putin. Kind of mathematically speaking, it's sort of a scientific fact. Bill Hicks could prove it on an Etch-a-Sketch. It's sort of a, it's like a syllogism in geometry class, where if you wanted a worse war last week and then Putin came and stopped you by making peace instead, then you are worse than Putin. See? In D.C., they call that calculus. I call it basic, long division. How about that? Simple multiplication. You suck, Michelle Flournoy. You suck at winning wars in Afghanistan, and you suck at making wars worse in Ukraine. Well, but hey, wouldn't it be great for feminism to have a female Secretary of Defense? Isn't really that what matters more than anything? Wouldn't Michelle Flournoy be a great dynamic duo with Hillary Clinton? Can't you just see the ABC primetime drama now? Starring Gina Davis or something? Yeah, that'll get me nice and warmed up for Hillary. Show me a show about Gina Davis starting wars. And show me some Michelle Flournoy think tank reports, and that will get me nice and warmed up for the Hillary Clinton regime, which I'm actually not concerned about because I don't think it can be her. Now, see, so here's the argument. The argument is people are going to remember. When was the last time they lived under a Clinton? Seinfeld era, stuff like that, huh? And when was the last time they lived under a Bush? Man, that really did pretty much suck. Even if them damn hippies were not right all along that it sucked. And so when it comes down to it, they're going to choose her. But here's my thing. I don't think that's right. I think when it comes down to it, Americans are sexist. And I think even if you hate Hillary and Jeb the same in principle, she's got that whole bossy dragon lady thing that men and women kind of reject in a way. Unless they glom right onto it and love it, they don't like it too much. And it's a double standard. It's not fair. Because he's no less jerky than her, although he has murdered far less people. If it comes down to just, you know, who has most skulls on the scale. But I think they're going to try real hard to sell. Don't you wish it had been Jeb all along? And then probably the junior years wouldn't have been that bad. And he's got the money. And end of the day, Republicans will vote for whoever you tell them to. And so, I mean, whoever the GOP party leadership tells them to. And he has all the important constituencies in America locked up. The arms manufacturers, the bankers, the insurance companies, agribusiness. Now, I don't know if the Democrats run against him on showing a bunch of clips of Junior trying to privatize Social Security, so-called, you know, have government take all the Social Security money and invest it in the stock market bubble. Show him a bunch of clips of that. That might just win it for the Democrats, because old people actually vote. And that was about the most ham-handed, grand theft pension that anyone could think of. And then, of course, the entire stock market bubble collapsed 2 years after he failed to get that through. You know what I mean? Yep, retired people, they pay attention to stuff like who's sending them checks in the mail all day. And they will vote for a living, no doubt about it. But anyway, I think it's, 70-30, 80-20 money on Jeb. Safe bet. Jeb is the next dictator. Boy, it's going to be terrible, too. It's going to be worse than this. It's going to be really bad. All right. Hey, listen, here's something I want to complain about before I run out of time. There's a bomb threat at the Islamic Center, more or less pretty much in my neighborhood this morning, according to the local news Twitter feed at the local news station here. And there was another one at some Islamic store of some kind, apparently down near the university somewhere. Are you kidding me? That better be some punk-ass 14-year-old just getting in trouble and not some kind of, Republican. Man, that pisses me off. And, here's the thing about it. It's, because how stupid do you gotta be? Seriously. They hate us because they're Muslims to work on you. Really? You don't remember cheering for George H.W. Bush mass murdering a bunch of Muslim Arabs and putting bases in the Arabian Peninsula. And you don't remember Bill Clinton keeping them there. And you don't remember George W. Bush killing another million people on top of the ones that Bill Clinton had blockaded to death. You don't remember they got rid of every dictator with a shaven chin that they could find that used to work for them in order to support at least in effect and sometimes outright the bin Ladenite suicide bomber prisoner crucifier lunatics. Nope. All these people just wake up bent out of shape that there's such a thing as the new world over across the ocean and they just want to set it on fire because of how great it is. How stupid. You're telling me grown adults believe in that? Yeah, you know what happens is, the better we are, the more they hate us. Yeah. The stronger they squint their eyes, the more they believe their religion. And the more they believe their religion, the more they just want to blow themselves up around something beautiful. Yeah. Well, hey, if that's what TV says... You know, Marcy Wheeler reminded a tweet from a story from 2 years ago where there was an attempted anti-Muslim attack in Canada where the guy said, hey, all I know is what I watch on Fox News and hear on the radio. Yeah, anti-Muslim bigotry all day long. Stupid bigotry all day long. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I know it's stupid politics stuff, but I think it's funny. It's all on Twitter where the new Secretary of Defense is being sworn in and giving his speech, and Joe Biden is all hitting on his wife and feeling all over her, whispering in her ear and rubbing her shoulders and stuff. Jesus, get a hold of yourself, Mr. Vice President. Fuck. In fact, there's like one little vine where the new Secretary of Defense kind of reaches over and puts his hand on her like, no, this one belongs to me. You step aside now. It's kind of funny. It's just a little bit funny. Joe Biden, what a scumbag. Anyway, all right. Hey, coming up, Jason Ditz will be on the show. Right now at the Ron Paul Institute, they noticed somebody wrote up the breaking news story from my interview with Ron Paul about the terror war, about how at the end he said he's writing a book about the war. So that's cool. They wrote up a little thing about that at the Ron Paul Institute. Happy to see that. And also happy to see that the Center for American Progress, I know, boo. I'm not going to stop you. Go ahead, boo. Yeah, I know. They're terrible. They're terrible. Center for American Progress. Libya war supporters, for one thing. But check it out, though. Fear, Inc. Remember our friend Eli Clifton and a few others wrote up a thing called Fear, Inc. a few years ago, and it was a study of who is bankrolling the hate and fear Muslims industry in America. And, of course, it's Friends of Israel, stupid. What are you, stupid? It's the Israelis. They're trying to deceive you into thinking that their enemies are your enemies. That's called calculus in Washington, D.C. It's simple arithmetic to me. Okay. It's the Israel lobby that wants you to hate and fear Muslims. But anyway, so here they got an updated report just out. And I'm going to see if I can get one of these guys on to talk about it. The Islamophobia Network's efforts to manufacture hate in America. That's the whole thing about this, man. You know, I'm repeating myself, but it's important, I think, you know, the point. Like Anthony Gregory said, George Bush used to say, hey, it's not Islam, man. It's just these guys are a weird, sick, perverted, break-off group of wacko psycho killers that don't represent Islam, and our war is not against Islam. That's what he would say while he was, you know, getting a million Muslims killed. He at least was telling the American right, hey man, don't consider your Muslim neighbors to be your enemies because they're not, sorta. But then as soon as he was gone and Mr. Kenyan secret Muslim birther usurper and all this kind of thing come to power, and that was like taking the lid off the pot and it's completely boiled over. And then on top of that, you have the desperate attempt by Israel to confuse Americans into thinking that there's no difference between the Ayatollah and the Caliph, when actually, yeah, sort of there is. And in fact, they just assume you confuse a Palestinian baby with the Caliph Ibrahim, Mr. leader of all Muslims on earth, self-proclaimed, with 0.00001% of the Muslim population of earth following him, I might note. Okay, now that actually would be some math I can't do in my head right there. What if you, hey, chat room guys, help me out. If you got, 2 or 3 billion Muslims in the world, and if you have, let's be generous, 100,000 members of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. In fact, that's being generous, including all of them across the earth, including little franchises in the Maghreb and wherever else. What's the percent of that? What percent of 3 billion people is a couple hundred thousand? Maybe 100,000, really. Anyway, we'll see if the chat room guys answer. I don't know if they'll... But anyway, I'm going to interview this somebody about this. I think this is so important that people get this out. I love this. Chapter 4 here. Islamophobia masquerading as law enforcement counterterrorism training. Hey, the phone's ringing off the hook, Chief. These guys say they're going to teach us how to stop terrorism, and we'll get more money if we hire them. So let's do it. And you have, just imagine what these meathead idiots are telling each other about the terror war. Yes, your county, too, is a threat for a September 11th-like attack. Okay, so good. There are worthwhile things about liberals. Center for American Progress, Fear, Inc., 2.0, the Islamophobia Network's efforts to manufacture hate in America, an interview with somebody from this study sometime soon on this show, I promise. Very important work there. They already got one. I interviewed Eli Clifton about it last time, I think. And there's a few like this, too. I think even Max Blumenthal helped write up one at Alternet one time. And they're all, you know, very directly tied to the neoconservative movement and the Israel lobby, of course, which is pretty much the same thing. Okay. I mentioned yesterday, but only briefly because we're going out to break and it bears repeating. It's worth repeating. And that is that the White House thinks that Benjamin Netanyahu is leaking information about the secret negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program in an effort to undermine it, just like he swore he would do anything he could to undermine the deal. Quote, we'll do everything to prevent Iran deal. That's at Israel National News. Well, it was in, I forget which Israeli paper, reported that they're working on a deal that may let the Iranians have 6,500 or 7,000 spinning centrifuges, and then they're supposed to spin that. As we already saw on Twitter, I got in a fight with one kook yesterday on Twitter, a War Party front man, trying to pretend that that amounts to a 10-month breakout period. Oh, yeah, sure it does, according to your ridiculous and stupid imagination. In fact, one of the worst hawks in America, Gary Samore, even said, come on, breakout period is meaningless anyway. They're not going to break out toward a bomb. They're going to take what? They're going to take the Natanz facility after all this and after a new deal, and then they're going to race for, even pretend, 10 months to build a bomb and think that they're going to do that before America and Israel attack them? America and Israel can't gin up an air war in 10 months? Is that what we're supposed to believe? That they would even try that? That their policy is somehow that that's what they're working toward? Enough. Stupid, evil, lying Israeli government. I'm so sick of them. And all of their front men. And anyway, you know what? I don't know if Obama's going to do what it takes to get this deal through. He's going to have to guarantee to lift enough sanctions for the Iranians to be able to spin it back home and all that kind of thing. And we'll see if the Israelis can help screw it up or not. I'm happy to find out that I don't think there's any backing down now, that Netanyahu is definitely coming and giving this speech. And I think it's going to be an absolute disaster for him and for Israel and a great benefit to these negotiations. I hope. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Okay, guys. Couple of notes very quickly before we go to our next guest. First of all, Christian Stork has a correction. He has it right in the article, but he misstated it on the show. It is not General Dynamics. It's Raytheon and Lockheed that produce the Javelin missile. So, slight point of fact, but he wanted to make sure everybody's clear on that. He's corrected there. And then the question was, and I'm estimating, both of these numbers are estimates. I think I'm more or less pretty much right that there's 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. That's what they say, right? And then JDA in the chat room divided that by a very generous estimate of 100,000 Islamic State and Al-Qaeda fighters in the world. And then stop typing things, you people. I need, now I got a page up. That is equals point, where did it go? Point 00769230 something something percent. Point 0.0076% of Muslims. And that's assuming my very generous estimate, I think, of 100,000. Okay, anyway, so there you go. It's not representative at all, really. Okay, thanks. All right, Jason Ditz is on the line. Thank God. He is the managing news editor of antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com for his take on everything that you need to know. All day, every day. It's incredible work. 10,000 entries there. News.antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. And now I got to find my link, man. I had it here just a second ago, but we got brand new and important NSA news. Well, here it is on the site. Advanced cybercrime gang closely linked to NSA. You don't say, even though it rhymes. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, calling them a cybercrime gang, I think, is Kaspersky Labs' way of being a bit generous because they don't know all the details of how it's organized. It really seems, at least from the report that they submitted, that this is not so much an independent gang as just flat out an NSA operation.
Yeah, just well, I wonder. So, well, what is? Do they have any real reason to distinguish between the two?
Only because they haven't conclusively got internal documents from the NSA linking the two. Other than that, not really. It seems like this is pretty straightforward that this is one of the NSA's operations for espionage. This is collecting data on targets of interest with malware.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, how you reported the other day, you linked to this article by Bill Gertz, of course. Is he formerly with the Washington Times? I don't know, but we all know who Bill Gertz is, right? Washington Times, connected to the Pentagon, right-wing reporter. And he was saying the NSA is getting ready for this thing that's about to hit. And so they almost were, they went ahead and admitted their own guilt to a greater degree than they ended up being publicly accused, it sounds like.
Right. It was, well, the NSA says that there's going to be a leak coming very soon and they're gearing up for the fallout from it, and it's going to be detailing their operations, and it's going to come not from a leak like the Snowden leaks where it's an insider, but from a security firm not operating out of the United States. And, of course, the following day, Kaspersky Labs, which is a Russian company, unveils this huge report on this this equation group, which very much seems to be part of the NSA.
Yeah, just an office at Fort Meade. Sounds like. All right. All right, now, so what's the big scandal? What have they been up to?
Well, quite a bit, as it turns out. They've got some of the most advanced malware on the planet, infecting computers, a lot of them industrial computers, foreign governments. Some of them are just corporations that are seen as particularly likely to have useful information. Some individuals are likely infected too. We don't really know the scope of the infections because these are so advanced that they're very hard, even for really advanced antivirus systems, to detect.
Now, is it the kind of thing where AVG and those kinds of things, Avast, they'll be able to just update their database and those programs will be able to find these now that they have been identified? Or you're saying they might still be able to even hide from the seekers?
Well, hopefully, now that the Kaspersky report is out, they will be able to detect most of them in ways that they weren't able to before. Some of the more advanced techniques, like overwriting the firmware on hard drives, I'm not sure it's even theoretically possible to develop antivirus software that could detect that. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the hard drive firmware is not meant to be read at an operating system level, let alone at an end antivirus program level.
I see what you're saying. So, and that's the thing that's getting the big headlines, right, is the embedding it deep into the hard drives. But now, so how is that accomplished? They got spies that work at the factories, or they just sneak some code? They break into the manufacturer's computers and sneak code into their firmware code, or what the hell?
No, it seems like this is, as I say, it's not meant to be accessed from an operating system level, the firmware, but theoretically it can be, and a lot of this access to the firmware is not well documented. A lot of it is manufacturer to manufacturer specific, but somehow this group, which I guess the somehow is because they're the NSA, was able to come up with how it's done on virtually every major manufacturer. So once they compromise a computer, if it's a computer that they deem important enough, they can do this.
I see. So it's still targeted for the owner of the computer itself. They're not all leaving the factory like this with an embedded flaw.
Right. Although, interestingly enough, they have intercepted some CD-ROMs of software from factories and infected them on their way to customers that were considered important targets. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't discount the possibility that if a target is getting a shipment of hard drives, that they might intercept the shipment of hard drives and pre-install the firmware on it.
Yeah, didn't Greenwald, or was it the Washington Post, even published a picture of them doing it, right? Opening up the packages?
Right, and we've seen reports off and on Twitter from people that are higher ups in cybersecurity, private cybersecurity experts that have packages get this, they call it interdiction, where their package just gets inexplicably rerouted to Virginia on its way to them, and then by the time it shows up, it's presumably been compromised. I've seen reports of people ordering keyboards from places like Amazon. It leaves on UPS like a normal shipment. It's going from, you know, Texas to California. For some reason, all of a sudden, it takes a detour to Renton, Virginia, spends a couple days in Virginia, and then gets sent to California. And obviously, you can't use that keyboard at that point because, you know, they installed something in it.
Right.
But it's really incredible.
You know, if you wrote a novel like this, I'd be like, I don't know, Jason. It doesn't really hold up, man. But no, yeah, that's how they do it. All right, I'm sorry. We'll be right back, y'all. It's the great Jason Ditz from antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. I got Jason Ditz on the line. He's the news editor at antiwar.com. That's news.antiwar.com. And we're talking about the latest NSA scandal here. And I want to see if I read you right here, if I understand you right. I forget if you said or not, Jason, but you're right here that they've been doing this. The experts... believe that this malware has been in existence since 2001 or even possibly as far back as 1996, that they've been able to successfully do this. In other words, they've been getting away with blue bloody murder for a long, long time on this. And then do I understand the cause and effect in the chronology here, that the reason they're busted, that they're the ones who have done this, is because they then use the same successful code as the basis of the Stuxnet virus that they used against Iran that had its flaws and escaped out into the wild and ended up getting caught. And so this is an example of their, horrible processes that they use, where they expose and sabotage and destroy a great, from their point of view, success in order to fail in another way.
Well, that's certainly part of it. I mean, that's certainly where the obvious connections to the NSA and the U.S. government come in. But some of this is just plain bad luck with their malware. Some of the malware just happened to finally get caught by security researchers. And what they do in this case, their malware is very sophisticated. It starts at a operating system level, unless, of course, it's one of those cases where the hard drive is also compromised. But it goes through several different checks to make sure that it's not going to be detected. And if even one of those checks fails and there's even a hint of a chance that it's going to get detected, it self-destructs itself. It wipes itself completely clean. And to prevent security companies from being able to figure out what happened. Now, somewhere along the line, some of these just didn't do that right. And that's how Kaspersky finally got a hold of some of this code, found some of these CD-ROMs that were supposedly Oracle-manufactured CD-ROMs, but were actually copies that had malware installed on them. And they finally just started breaking through this and figuring out what they were doing.
Well, they sure sound like some mean mathematicians over there at the NSA. Do the other hacker types, do they ever say, wow, man, now that's some badass malware? Or is it that much more advanced than malware produced out in the free market?
Well, in some ways, it seems to be some of the most advanced malware on the market, because the NSA has access to these routes that, you know, a normal hacker organization isn't going to be able to reroute packages.
Right.
And they're not going to be able to force hard drive manufacturers to hand over details of their the inner workings of their hardware. Some of this is things like that, but certainly some of the exploits that the NSA is taking advantage of here do end up getting copied by the private malware sector as well.
Yeah, that's a funny thing about the NSA, right? They're in charge of cybersecurity and undermining all security at the same time. I wonder which side's winning on any given day.
Right, and RSA had one of the was considered one of the most reliable commercial security software for encryption for years, and the NSA, it turned out, had paid them off to deliberately compromise some of the methods through which they were encrypting data, so that the NSA could decrypt it at will. So they've been deliberately going out of their way to make commercial software worse.
That's funny. Yeah, and you know, I'm sure you know much better than me how all the stories about how the internet companies have suffered so badly since all the Snowden revelations came out in terms of their international business. And this, I saw some remarks on Twitter along those lines about these American hardware companies too now, where just the U.S. government keeps making American business suspect in every other market on Earth, where people are just, I mean, not like anybody else is necessarily immune from us, but with the Americans, you know you're getting screwed. It's basically the brand that they're selling now.
Right, and I think that's ultimately going to be, if we ever get serious NSA reforms, that's going to have to be where it comes from, because I don't think politically there's enough clout anywhere else. But if companies like IBM start losing international business because they simply don't trust Americans anymore, because they know all American hardware is potentially compromised by the NSA, I think it's going to have to force at least some reforms on the extent to which they do this.
Right. Well, and you know, if a corporation like that can't ask the empire to tone it down a little bit on an issue that is really killing them, then that just goes to show how big the empire has grown, because it ain't like they've gotten any smaller.
Right. And we have seen, I mean, some limited extent, and there's been a lot of dispute in the financial markets as to how much of this is just coincidence and how much of it is because of the NSA, but we have seen American hardware manufacturers losing some overseas business. So I think it is starting to have an impact on the bottom line for companies like IBM. Exactly how much, IBM is probably in a better position to say than anybody, but so far they've been relatively mum on it, and I think if it gets worse and it starts affecting more and more companies, you're going to start to see a backlash. I'm surprised Microsoft, another one, isn't doing this, because all of the malware we're talking about with this new report is targeted at Microsoft's operating systems. It hits literally every commercial Windows release since the mid-90s. And, you know, that's a big incentive to use something other than Windows.
That's what I was thinking while I was reading it. I guess, I don't know. I always hear Linux described as, yeah, it's great, but then when you download Adobe products from the Pirate Bay, they're not going to work right. You know, you got to have Windows to run those. Is that not right?
Well, I mean, that's probably beyond the scope of this discussion. Certainly, you can run them in Wine, which is a program within Linux that allows you to run certain Windows programs.
Yeah, that sounds like I got to be smarter to be able to do it. That's what I've always thought about.
I don't know if we want to get too into detail about how to do that with pirated versions of software or not, but it's definitely doable.
Yeah. Hey, the Pirate Bay lives, man. I ain't afraid to say it. I love those guys. They got your first run movies too, everybody. All right. Hey, listen, let me ask you about this real quick in a couple of minutes we got left here. Tell me about Netanyahu and his leaks and the politics around Netanyahu's attempt to sabotage the Iran nuclear talks.
Well, it's really incredible. He openly said earlier this month I will do anything I can to sabotage these nuclear talks to make sure that no deal is reached. I mean, it wasn't even him sort of hinting at it. He flat out said, I'm going to do this. Then, a week later, it comes out, well, the U.S. isn't sharing all of its secret information about the talks with him anymore because they don't trust him not to leak parts to try to sabotage it. And Netanyahu is acting shocked by this, as though he didn't just say he was going to do literally anything he could to sabotage those talks.
Yeah, I mean, it was like the minutes from his cabinet meeting where he told Smithers, publish that in the Israeli Times or whatever, Ynet.
Right. He's gone out of his way to make public his intention to sabotage U.S. diplomacy, and yet he acts shocked that the U.S. isn't giving him all the minutes of all their diplomatic details.
Yeah. And I got my footnote wrong. It was Israel National News is where they got the best quote here about do anything that it'll take. Well, anyway, I think it's blown up in his face, and it's certainly a lot of fun to read your articles about it. I know that. thanks very much, Jace, for coming on the show. I appreciate it as always, dude.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, y'all, that's the great Jason. It's news.antiwar.com. Go read it right now. See you tomorrow.